some audio of Only Love Is Real, the story of soulmates reunited. Dr. Brian Weiss. 1996. Preface. The soul of man is like to water, from heaven it cometh to heaven it riseth and then returneth to earth, forever alternating. Goethe. Just before my first book, Many Lives, Many Masters, was published, I visited the owner of a local bookstore to see if he had ordered it. We checked his computer. 4 copies, he told me. Do you want to order one? I wasn't very sure that sales of the book would ever reach the modest amount that the publisher had printed. After all, this was a very strange book for a respected psychiatrist to have written. The book describes the true story of a young patient of mine whose past life therapy dramatically changed both our lives. However, I knew that my friends, neighbors, and, certainly, my relatives would buy more than 4 copies, even if the book didn't sell anywhere else in the country. Please, I said to him. My friends, some of my patients, and other people I know will be coming here looking for my book. Can't you order more? I had to personally guarantee the 100 books he reluctantly ordered. To my utter shock, the book has become an international bestseller with more than 2 million copies in print, and it has been translated into more than 20 languages. My life had taken another unusual twist. After being graduated with honors from Columbia University and completing my medical training at the Yale University School of Medicine, I also completed an internship at New York University's teaching hospitals and a residency in psychiatry at Yale. Afterward, I was a professor on the medical faculties at the University of Pittsburgh and the University of Miami. For the following 11 years, I was chairman of the psychiatry department at Mount Sinai Medical Center in Miami. I had written many scientific papers and book chapters. I was at the apex of an academic career. Catherine, the young patient described in my first book, then walked into my office in Mount Sinai. Her detailed memories of past lifetimes, which I did not initially believe, and her ability to transmit transcendental messages while in a hypnotized trance state, turned my life upside down. I could no longer see the world as I had before. After Catherine, many more patients came to me for past life regression therapy. People with symptoms resistant to traditional medical treatments and psychotherapies were being cured. Through Time into Healing, my second book, describes what I have learned about the healing potential of past life regression therapy. The book is filled with true case stories of actual patients. The most intriguing story of all is in Only Love Is Real, my third book. This book is about soulmates, people who are bonded eternally by their love and who come around together and together again, life after life. How we find and recognize our soulmates and the life-transforming decisions we must then make are among the most moving and important moments in our lives. Destiny dictates the meeting of soulmates. We will meet them. But what we decide to do after that meeting falls in the province of choice or free will. A wrong choice or a missed chance can lead to incredible loneliness and suffering. A right choice, an opportunity realized, can bring us to profound bliss and happiness. Elizabeth, a beautiful woman from the Midwest, began therapy with me because of her profound grief and anxiety after the death of her mother. She had also been having problems in her relationships with men, choosing losers, abusers, and other toxic partners. She had never found true love in any male relationship. We began the journey back to distant times, with surprising results. At the same time that Elizabeth was undergoing past life therapy with me, I was also treating Pedro, a charming Mexican who was also suffering from grief. His brother had recently died in a tragic accident. In addition, problems with his mother and secrets from his younger days seemed to be conspiring against him. Pedro was burdened with despair and doubts, and he had no one with whom to share his troubles. He, too, began a search into ancient times to seek solutions and healing. Although Elizabeth and Pedro were in therapy with me during the same time period, they had never met each other, as their appointments were scheduled on different days of the week. Over the past 15 years, I have often treated couples and families who have discovered present-day partners and loved ones in their past lives. Sometimes I have regressed couples who simultaneously and for the first time have found themselves interacting in the same prior lifetime. These revelations are often shocking to the couple. They have not experienced anything like this before. They are silent while the scenes unfold in my psychiatric office. It is only afterward, after emerging from the relaxed, hypnotic state, that they first discover they have been watching the same scenes, feeling the same emotions. It is only then that I also become aware of their past life connections. But with Elizabeth and Pedro, everything was reversed. Their lives, and their lifetimes, were unfolding independently and quite separately in my office. They did not know each other. They had never met. They were from different countries and cultures. Even I, seeing them both separately and having no reason to suspect a link between them, did not make a connection. Yet they seem to be describing the same past lifetimes with stunning similarity of detail and emotion. Could they have loved each other and lost each other across lifetimes? In the beginning, none of us was aware of the gripping drama that had already begun to unfold in the unsuspecting serenity of my office. I was the first to discover their connection. But now what? Should I tell them? What if I were wrong? What about patient-doctor confidentiality? What about their current relationships? What about tinkering with destiny? What if a current life connection was not in their plans or even in their best interests? Would another failed relationship undermine both the therapeutic gains that they had made as well as their trust in me? It had been ingrained in me during my medical school years and subsequent psychiatry residency at the Yale University School of Medicine to do no harm to patients. When in doubt, do no harm. Both Elizabeth and Pedro were improving. Should I just let it go at that? Pedro was finishing his therapy and would soon leave the country. There was an urgency to my decision. Not all of their sessions, particularly Elizabeth's, are included in this book, as some sessions were not pertinent to their stories. Some were completely devoted to traditional psychotherapy and did not include hypnosis or regression. What follows is written from medical records, transcripts of tapes, and memory. Only names and minor details have been changed to ensure confidentiality. It is a story of destiny and of hope. It is a story that happens silently every day. On this day, someone was listening. Chapter 1, Know, therefore, that from the greater silence I shall return. Forget not that I shall come back to you. A little while, a moment of rest upon the wind, and another woman shall bear me. Khalil Gibran. There is someone special for everyone. Often there are two or three, or even four. They come from different generations. They travel across oceans of time and the depths of heavenly dimensions to be with you again. They come from the other side, from heaven. They look different, but your heart knows them. Your heart has held them in arms like yours in the moon-filled deserts of Egypt and the ancient plains of Mongolia. You have ridden together in the armies of forgotten warrior generals, and you have lived together in the sand-covered caves of the Ancient Ones. You are bonded together throughout eternity, and you will never be alone. Your head may interfere, I do not know you. Your heart knows. He takes your hand for the first time, and the memory of his touch transcends time and sends a jolt through every atom of your being. She looks into your eyes, and you see a soul companion across centuries. Your stomach turns upside down. Your arms are goose flesh. Everything outside this moment loses its importance. He may not recognize you, even though you have finally met again, even though you know him. You can feel the bond. You can see the potential, the future. But he does not. His fears, his intellect, his problems keep a veil over his heart's eyes. He does not let you help him sweep the veil aside. You mourn and grieve, and he moves on. Destiny can be so delicate. When both recognize each other, no volcano could erupt with more passion. The energy released is tremendous. Soul recognition may be immediate. A sudden feeling of familiarity, of knowing this new person at depths far beyond what the conscious mind could know. At depths usually reserved for the most intimate family members. Or even deeper than that. Intuitively knowing what to say, how they will react. A feeling of safety and a trust far greater than could be earned in only one day or one week or one month. Soul recognition may be subtle and slow. A dawning of awareness as the veil is gently lifted. Not everyone is ready to see right away. There is a timing at work, and patience may be necessary for the one who sees first. You may be awakened to the presence of your soul companion by a look, a dream, a memory, a feeling. You may be awakened by the touch of his hands or the kiss of her lips, and your soul is jolted back to life. The touch that awakens may be that of your child, of a parent, of a sibling, or of a true friend. Or it may be your beloved, reaching across the centuries, to kiss you once again and to remind you that you are together always, to the end of time. Chapter 2. My life as I lived it had often seemed to me like a story that has no beginning and no end. I had the feeling that I was a historical fragment, an excerpt for which the preceding and succeeding text was missing. I could well imagine that I might have lived in former centuries and there encountered questions I was not yet able to answer, that I had to be born again because I had not fulfilled the task that was given to me. Carl Jung. Tall, thin, and attractive with long blonde hair, Elizabeth had sad blue eyes with specks of hazel in them. Her melancholy eyes overpowered her loose navy blue business suit as she sat nervously in the large white leather reclining chair in my office. Elizabeth felt compelled to see me, searching for hope after reading many lives, many masters and identifying with Catherine, the book's heroine, on many levels. "I don't know much about why you're here," I commented, breaking the usual impasse at the beginning of therapy. I had briefly glanced at the information sheet all new patients fill out. Name, age, referral source, chief complaints and symptoms. Elizabeth had listed grief, anxiety, and sleep disturbances as her major maladies. As she began to talk, I mentally added relationships to her list. "My life is such a mess," she stated. Her history began to pour out, as if it were finally safe to talk about these things. The release of pent-up pressure was palpable. Despite the drama of her life's story and the depths of emotion lying just under the surface of her telling it, Elizabeth quickly minimized its importance. "My story is not nearly as dramatic as Catherine's," she said. "There won't be any book about me." Her story, dramatic or not, flowed forth. Elizabeth was a successful businesswoman with her own accounting firm in Miami. 32 years old, she was born and reared in rural Minnesota. She grew up on a large farm with her parents, an older brother, and many animals. Her father was a hard-working, stoical man who had great difficulty expressing his emotions. When he did display emotion, it was usually anger and rage. He would lose his temper and lash out impulsively at his family, sometimes striking her brother. The abuse Elizabeth received was only verbal, but it hurt her greatly. Deep within her heart, Elizabeth still carried this childhood wound. Her self-image had been damaged by her father's condemnations and criticisms. A profound pain enveloped her heart. She felt impaired and somehow defective, and she worried that others, especially men, could also perceive her shortcomings. Fortunately, her father's outbursts were infrequent, and he quickly retreated to the stern and stoical isolation that characterized his personality and behavior. Elizabeth's mother was a progressive and independent woman. She promoted Elizabeth's self-reliance while remaining warm and emotionally nurturing. Because of the children and the times, she chose to stay on the farm and to tolerate reluctantly her husband's harshness and emotional withdrawal. "My mother was like an angel," Elizabeth went on. "Always there, always caring, always sacrificing for the sake of her children." Elizabeth, the baby, was her mother's favorite. She had many fonder memories of childhood. The fondest of all were times of closeness to her mother, of the special love that bonded them together and that maintained itself over time. Elizabeth grew up, was graduated from high school, and went away to college in Miami, where she had been offered a generous scholarship. Miami seemed like an exotic adventure to her, and she was lured away from the cold Midwest. Her mother reveled in Elizabeth's adventures. They were best friends, and even though they mostly communicated by phone and mail, their mother-daughter relationship stayed strong. Holidays and vacations were happy times for them, as Elizabeth rarely missed a chance to go back home. During some of these visits, Elizabeth's mother talked about retiring to South Florida to be near Elizabeth. The family farm was large and increasingly difficult to run. They had saved a considerable amount of money, an amount augmented by her father's frugality. Elizabeth looked forward to living near her mother again. Their nearly daily contacts would no longer have to occur by telephone. So Elizabeth stayed in Miami after college. She started her own accounting firm, which was slowly building. Competition was keen, and the work absorbed great chunks of her time. Relationships with men added to her stress. Then disaster struck. Approximately 8 months prior to her first appointment with me, Elizabeth was devastated because of her mother's death from pancreatic cancer. Elizabeth felt as if her own heart had been torn apart and ripped out by the death of her beloved mother. She was having an enormously difficult time resolving her grief. She couldn't integrate it, couldn't understand why this had to happen. Elizabeth painfully told me about her mother's courageous battle with the virulent cancer that ravaged her body. Her spirit and her love remained untouched. Both women felt a profound sadness. Physical separation was inevitable, quietly but persistently approaching. Elizabeth's father, grieving in anticipation, grew even more distant, wrapped in his solitude. Her brother, living in California with a young family and a new business, kept a physical distance. Elizabeth traveled to Minnesota as often as possible. She had no one with whom to share her fears and her pain. She did not want to burden her dying mother any more than was absolutely necessary. So Elizabeth kept her despair inside, and each day felt increasingly heavy. "I will miss you so much. I love you," her mother told her. "The most difficult part is leaving you. I'm not afraid of dying. I'm not afraid of what awaits me. I just don't want to leave you yet." As she grew weaker and weaker, her mother's resolve to stay longer gradually diminished. Death would be a welcome relief from the debility and the pain. Her last day arrived. Elizabeth's mother was in the hospital, the small room crowded with family and visitors. Her breathing became erratic. The urine tubes showed no drainage, her kidneys had ceased to function. She lapsed into and out of consciousness. At one point Elizabeth found herself alone with her mother. At this moment her mother's eyes widened, and she became lucid again. "I won't leave you," her mother said in a suddenly firm voice. "I'll always love you." Those were the last words Elizabeth heard from her mother, who now lapsed into a coma. Her respirations became even more erratic, with long stops and sudden, gasping starts. Soon she was gone. Elizabeth felt a deep and gaping hole in her heart and in her life. She could actually feel a physical aching in her chest. She felt she would never be completely whole again. Elizabeth cried for months. Elizabeth missed the frequent phone calls with her mother. She tried calling her father more often, but he remained withdrawn and had very little to talk about. He would be off the phone within a minute or two. He was not capable of nurturing or comforting her. He also was grieving, and his grief isolated him even more. Her brother in California, with his wife and two young children, was also devastated by his mother's death, but he was busy with his family and career. Her grief began to evolve into a depression with increasingly significant symptoms. Elizabeth was having problems sleeping at night. She had difficulty falling asleep and she would awaken much too early in the morning, unable to fall back to sleep. She lost interest in food and began losing weight. She had a noticeable lack of energy. She lost enthusiasm for relationships, and her ability to concentrate became increasingly impaired. Before her mother's death, Elizabeth's anxiety consisted mainly of job stresses, such as deadlines and difficult decisions. She was also anxious at times about her relationships with men, with how she should act and what their responses would be. Elizabeth's anxiety levels increased dramatically after the death of her mother. She had lost her daily confidant and advisor, her closest friend. She had lost her primary source of guidance and support. Elizabeth felt disoriented, alone, adrift. She called for an appointment. Elizabeth came into my office hoping to find a past life in which she had been together with her mother or to contact her in a mystical experience. In books and lectures I have talked about people in meditative states having such mystical encounters with loved ones. Elizabeth had read my first book, and she seemed aware of the possibility of these experiences. As people open up to the possibility, even the probability, of life after the death of the physical body, of the continuation of consciousness after leaving the physical body, they begin to have more of these mystical experiences in dreams and in other altered states of consciousness. Whether these encounters are real or not is difficult to prove. But they are vivid and filled with feeling. Sometimes the person even becomes aware of specific information, facts or details that were known only to the deceased. These revelations from spiritual visits are difficult to ascribe solely to imagination. I believe now that such new knowledge is obtained, or visits are made, not because people wish this to happen, not because they need it, but because this is the way contacts are made. Often the messages are very similar, especially in dreams. I'm all right. I'm fine. Take care of yourself. I love you. Elizabeth was hoping for some type of reunion or contact with her mother. Her heartache needed some balm to ease the constant pain. More of her history emerged during this first session. Elizabeth had been married for a brief period of time to a local contractor, who had two children by a previous marriage. Although she was not passionately in love with this man, he was a good person, and she thought that this relationship would bring some stability into her life. But passion in a relationship cannot be artificially created. There can be respect, and there can be compassion, but the chemistry has to be there from the start. When Elizabeth discovered that her husband was having an extramarital affair with someone who could provide more excitement and passion, she reluctantly left the relationship. She was sad about the breakup and sad to leave the two children, but she did not grieve because of the divorce. The loss of her mother was much more severe. Because of her physical beauty, Elizabeth found it easy to meet and date other men after the divorce. But none of these relationships had fire either. Elizabeth began to doubt herself, to try to find where within herself the fault lay in her inability to establish good relationships with men. What is wrong with me? She would ask herself. And her self-esteem would dip another notch. The barbed arrows of her father's painful criticisms during her childhood had left wounds in her psyche. The failed relationships with men rubbed salt in these wounds. She began a relationship with a professor at a nearby university, but he could not commit to her because of his own fears. Even though there was a strong feeling of tenderness and understanding, and even though the two communicated very well, his inability to commit to a relationship and to trust his feelings doomed that relationship to a quiet and unspectacular ending. Some months later, Elizabeth met and began dating a successful banker. She felt secure and protected in this relationship, even though, once again, the chemistry was limited. He, however, was strongly attracted to Elizabeth and became angry and jealous when she did not reciprocate with the kind of energy and enthusiasm that he expected. He began to drink more, and he became physically abusive. Elizabeth left this relationship, too. She had been quietly despairing of ever meeting a man with whom she could have a good and intimate relationship. She had thrown herself into her work, enlarging her firm, hiding behind the numbers and calculations and paperwork. Her relationships primarily consisted of business contacts. And even though from time to time a man would ask her out, Elizabeth would do something to discourage that interest before it grew into anything serious. Elizabeth was aware that her biological clock was ticking, and she still hoped to meet the perfect man someday, but she had lost a great deal of confidence. The first therapy session, devoted to gathering historical information, formulating a diagnosis and therapeutic approach, and sowing the seeds of trust in our relationship, had ended. The ice had been broken. I decided not to use Prozac or other antidepressants at this time. We would aim for a cure, not just the covering over of her symptoms. At the next session, 1 week later, we would begin the arduous journey back through time. Chapter 3, So Long Ago. And yet I'm still the same Margaret. It's only our lives that grow old. We are where centuries only count as seconds, and after a thousand lives our eyes begin to open. Eugene O'Neill. Prior to my experiences with Catherine, I had never even heard of past life regression therapy. This was not taught when I was at Yale Medical School, nor anywhere else. I was to learn. I can still vividly remember the first time. I had instructed Catherine to travel backward in time, hoping to discover childhood traumas that had been repressed, or forgotten, and that I felt were causing her current symptoms of anxiety and depression. She had already reached a deeply hypnotized state, which I had induced by gently relaxing her with my voice. Her concentration was focused on my instructions. During her therapy session the week previously, we had used hypnosis for the first time. Catherine had remembered several childhood traumas with considerable detail and emotion. Usually in therapy, when forgotten traumas are remembered with their accompanying emotions, a process called catharsis, patients begin to improve. Catherine's symptoms remained severe, however, and I assumed that we had to uncover even more repressed childhood memories. Then she should improve. Carefully I took Catherine back to the age of 2, but she recalled no significant memories. I instructed her firmly and clearly, "Go back to the time from which your symptoms arise." I was totally shocked by her response. "I see white steps leading up to a building, a big white building with pillars, open in front. There are no doorways. I'm wearing a long dress. A sack made of rough material. My hair is braided, long blonde hair." Her name was Aronda, a young woman who lived nearly 4,000 years ago. She died suddenly in a flood or tidal wave, which devastated her village. "There are big waves knocking down trees. There's no place to run. It's cold. The water is cold. I have to save my baby, but I cannot. Just have to hold her tight. I drown. The water chokes me. I can't breathe, can't swallow. Salty water. My baby is torn out of my arms." Catherine had been gasping and having difficulty breathing during this tragic memory. Suddenly her body relaxed completely, and her breathing became deep and even. "I see clouds. My baby is with me. And others from my village. I see my brother." She was resting. That lifetime had ended. Although neither she nor I believed in past lives, we had both been dramatically introduced to an ancient experience. Incredibly, her lifelong fear of gagging, or choking, virtually disappeared after this one session. I knew that imagination or fantasy could not cure such deeply embedded, chronic symptoms. Cathartic memory could. Week after week, Catherine remembered more past lives. Her symptoms disappeared. She was cured, without the use of any medicines. Together, we had discovered the healing power of regression therapy. Because of my skepticism and rigorous scientific training, I had a difficult time accepting the concept of past lives. Two factors eroded my skepticism, one rapid and highly emotional, the other gradual and intellectual. In one session, Catherine had just remembered her death in an ancient lifetime, a death from an epidemic that had swept through the land. She was still in a deep hypnotic trance, aware of floating above her body, being drawn to a beautiful light. She began to speak. "They tell me there are many gods, for God is in each of us." She then began to tell me very private details about the lives and deaths of my father and my infant son. They had both died years previously, far away from Miami. Catherine, a laboratory technician at Mount Sinai Medical Center, knew nothing at all about them. There was no person who could have given her these details. There was no place to look up this information. She was stunningly accurate. I felt shocked and chilled as she related these hidden, secret truths. "Who?" I asked her. "Who is there? Who tells you these things?" "The masters," she whispered. "The master spirits tell me. They tell me I have lived 86 times in physical state." Catherine later described the masters as highly evolved souls not presently in body who could speak to me through her. From them I received spectacular and profound information and insights. Catherine had no background in physics or metaphysics. The knowledge the masters transmitted seemed far beyond Catherine's capabilities. She knew nothing about dimensional planes and vibrational levels. Yet, deep in the trance state, she described these complex phenomena. Beyond that, the beauty of her words and thoughts and the philosophical implications of her utterings far transcended her conscious abilities. Catherine had never before talked in such a concise, poetic manner. When I listened to her as she relayed concepts from the masters, I could sense another, higher force struggling with her mind and vocal cords to translate these thoughts into words so that I could understand them.